and it's very short term in duration. Sexually violent predators have antisocial behavioral disorders or personality disorders, which require a very different type of treatment. The criminal justice system is set up for long-term confinement of individuals who are likely to commit violent crimes. And the civil system, as you know, is set up for more short-duration treatment needs of people with mental illnesses. And there are several mechanisms within the criminal system now and public safety system, including sentencing laws, good time provisions, victim notification, rigorous prosecution, sex offender registration, parole, probation conditions, intensive supervision, which are all appropriate mechanisms for addressing sexual predators within the criminal justice system. And we encourage you to consider those options and to enhance those options for protecting the public safety. And many of them are being currently considered by the legislature right now. I guess the board's second main point is if the legislation is pursued, that we do need significant safeguards for people with mental illnesses in the public mental health system. And in one area where a safeguard is needed, and there has been some response by the sponsor and the administration with this, is to narrowly define the population so that the law only applies to the most dangerous violent offenders who pose a very significant risk, you know, to the public. And there has been some attempt to narrow that definition. The other important issue is that these facilities be very separate and the treatment programs be very separate from those for the mentally ill. And again, there have been some accommodations made in the legislation, but we really need to ensure the safety of people with mental illnesses and that the security needs with sexual predators are much higher. And we really need to make sure that we're preserving the mission and integrity of the public mental health system so that our ability to serve people who are truly mentally ill is not undermined or jeopardized. And lastly, that the treatment approaches, as been talked about by several people today, the treatment approaches and the philosophy must recognize that there are very significant differences in dealing with criminal offenders versus treatable mentally ill. And the last aspect of this, and there is a separate fiscal note, is we do have concern that resources are not diverted, the funding resources are not diverted away from treating people with mental illnesses to treat people who are sex offenders, and that the funding for this be separate and not come from existing funding for the public mental health system. There is one specific issue. I did draft a letter and send a letter to you, and hopefully committee members have received that, where there is a particular amendment that I was proposing which has to do with achieving a safeguard. And what this amendment would do is to disallow the treatment of sexually violent predators at API, at the state's central psychiatric facility. Now, the way that the fiscal note was prepared by the administration already assumes that the people would not receive treatment at API, that it would be in fact contracted out. But there is nothing to prohibit that treatment from happening at API. Our concern is again, the more people with sexual predators that are treated at API, which again is very long duration, the less mentally ill people that can be treated at API. One thing that committee members may or may not be aware of is we are in the process now of downsizing API, and this will happen within the next couple years, from 79 beds to 54 beds. So once again, it'll become much more critical. Every bed will be very precious. And so our request to you for your consideration is to add some language, which we have suggested, and also the area where it would be added, that would disallow the treatment of these persons at the state psychiatric facility, namely API. And this, I have discussed this with Mr. Stoltz and with Senator Halford, and I'm not sure what their current position is relative to that change, but it's one that the mental health community is feels very strongly about, mental health consumer organizations, and I have discussed it personally with the Commissioner of Health and Social Services today, and it's a change that she supports. And I thank you for your consideration.
Okay. And so you would.
Let me move that.
Yeah, no, unfortunately. Yeah, we do. All right, this would be amendment number two. And it has been moved. Does everyone have a copy?
Yeah.
That we would
not provide treatment of these persons state sentence.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
Is there objection? Hearing none. Amendment number two is adopted. See how glib-tongued you are?
Thank you very much.
Okay, now we have on teleconference, and we should probably get them in. They've been waiting patiently. Blair McCune, are you on in Anchorage?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
We'll take your testimony now, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Blair McCune. I'm Deputy Director of the Alaska Public Defender Agency. We submitted a fiscal note to the bill, and in the fiscal note, I went over a little bit about the history of this type of law. I think it's important to point out that this would be the first time in Alaska where people would ever be confined, you know, based on a prediction that they might commit criminal offenses in the future. It's a real slippery slope, and that type of determination is, you know, not favored in the law because it's potentially is violating our right to liberty under the Constitution, due process, which is called substantive due process. So we have some philosophical problems with the bill. Also, I wanted to note the task force report of the American Psychiatric Association. This group of the people, the very experts of staff that make these determinations, feel that they should not be made. That it kind of distorts the traditional civil commitment process, and I think that the psychiatric community is certainly reluctant, somewhat unwilling, and by their own admission, unable to make the predictions called for in the bill. I wanted to just briefly maybe talk about a concern that echo Mr. Lindstrom's concern about. The idea of the tool or the toolkit, the pressure, I understand that the statistics in the Department of Law's fiscal note says that 160 sex offenders are released from jail yearly. The pressure, to have commitments of more than five, we think might be pretty strong. We've also, in conjunction with that, I don't want to go on too long, I think that the real key point to be made, though, is that the definition of mental illness in the bill is a very broad definition. It means any mental condition that increases the propensity of the defendant to be dangerous to the public peace and safety. So, I mean, that's the reason that I maybe I can go in a little bit about, Representative James was talking about commitment for the criminally insane and so on. To give a little history, in 1982, the legislature really changed the not guilty by reason of insanity laws to make it very difficult for someone to raise that defense. And there's very, very few people who are able to prove or to have the state disprove, as in the case of this defense, that they are not aware of the nature and quality of their act because of mental disease defect. So we got mental disease defect defined very narrowly in one part of that statute. The statute that I just quoted that's referred to in this bill is the statute that talks about mental illness for people to get out of such a commitment. Then there's another definition of mental illness in Title 47, which we were talking about. Alaska statutes 47, 39, 15, and that's the mental health commitment to API for people who are either gravely disabled or pose a danger to themselves or others, and that's a pretty strict definition. It means an organic mental or emotional disturbance that has real serious adverse effects on an individual's ability to perceive reality and so on. So there's kind of three different definitions of mental illness in the statutes that you're dealing with in conjunction with mental illness. It's really complicated. But the one that was chosen is the very, very broadest definition available. When we think of a sexually violent offense, we usually think of a rape or a serious sexual abuse in a minor case. But if you look at the types of crimes that are listed, even an attempt to have sexual contact with another person is qualified as a sexually violent offense. So in order to be released, somebody, I guess, would have to prove that they're safe in the sense that they would not even attempt any type of sexual contact with another person without another person's consent. So, and one final thing I wanted to talk about, the sex offender treatment in the Department of Corrections. I've had some experience in those cases because we do parole board hearings. There's a law in the books where if someone is offered sex offender treatment but refuses to take it, they can have their mandatory release of good time parole. The good time they earn in jail can be taken away before they're released. And I looked at the UAA study. It's very sparingly offered. If anybody files an appeal manifests a disinclination to do that through any other kind of legal proceeding, there it's not offered to the person. Only like over 90% of the people who go through the program do not pass or do not complete it. I think there's really just been a handful of people who successfully completed the program over the years. So it's not something that's offered as a matter of routine of men in jail. Maybe that's something the legislature ought to look at and think about funding, given the comments of Representative James and Representative Berkowitz. We checked with other public defenders in King County. It is a very expensive program. I could provide a little bit of material, but I just kind of talked to them generally. I didn't have much time, but the reason it's so expensive is because it's a civil trial rather than a criminal trial, so you have discovery. You need to hire experts. Incidentally, we agree with Ms. Carpinetti's amendment. We already figured that, in the standard operating procedure that we have, we figured that we'd end up having to hire the experts too, because the court never does it for us. So we upped our usual contractual line in our fiscal note. You'll see that's probably higher than we have it in other situations. So we've already taken that into account. If there's any other questions, I'd be happy to try to help. There's one thing on the size of the jury. It's in Superior Court, so it'd have to be a jury of 12. And if any other questions, if I could help answer, I'd be happy to.
Blair, you bring up an interesting point. We apparently are looking at a 2% review that would probably fall into this category, which was three or four people each year. If we're talking, in essence, of people who are sexual predators that were arrested because of a deviant act, is the 2% in your estimation even close to being reasonable? Are we looking at maybe no? By the time these guys get looked at, with the high recidivism rate they've got and all these other things that are working against them, it ain't going to be 2%, it's going to be maybe 50%.
That's our fear. I put that in the fiscal note. We use the Department of Law's figures because they have the discretion as to whether or not to bring these cases. Mr. Lindstrom's, the Department of Health and Social Services would be required to screen people, and with the definition of mental illness being so broad and the types of offenses that that qualify as sexually violent offenses being so broad, and the requirement, I think, in the screening process is that they have to kind of certify somebody is safe to be at large. Maybe that's in the release, but I know that somebody is safe to be at large is a slippery slope for psychologists or psychiatrists to, you know, have to guarantee that somebody's safe. Something they, in my experience, the criminal lawyer rarely like to do. I'd be afraid that there would be more people, but there's more than predicted now.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Brookberg.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. McCune, I've just taken a moment to look at the Constitution of the State of Alaska. Article 1, Section 12 provides that the criminal administration be based on the principle of reformation, among other things. And the case law in the state is such that the number one goal of criminal sanctions is rehabilitation, and it seems to be the majority of the case law in the state. Do you think, as a public defender, that you would use that as a means of attacking this legislation if it were enacted into law and to find it unconstitutional?
Well, through the chair, Representative Brookberg, this law actually is a civil law, so I don't think the Article 1, Section 12 would generally apply. The way I think it was, well, the way it was attacked in Kansas versus Hendricks was a violation of due process of law, substantive due process. That means depriving someone of liberty without process of law. And also as an ex post facto law, in other words, a law that is enacted now to apply to someone who's already been convicted of a crime. And then, as a double jeopardy, in other words, I've been punished before, is this punishment again? And the way state would have to argue against that is kind of exactly what Representative Bundy has referred to. Is the purpose of this law to keep people off the street, or is this a law to treat people of an affliction in their best interests and society, looking after someone who's not able to help themselves? If it's deemed to be a law that's just locking people up, it's more likely to lose under the ex post facto or double jeopardy or even the due process law. I hope that answers the question.
Thank you. Yes, it
does. Blair, it's come to my attention that on that jury number, under Rule 47 of Civil Rules, that parties could stipulate to a jury less than 12. It says the parties may stipulate that the jury shall consist of any number less than 12, and goes on then. So apparently we could have a smaller jury.
Yeah, I would think that a person faced with a potential lifetime of commitment would want a big jury, and would not stipulate to a jury of less than 12. But that's, you know, there might be some people who would want a smaller jury, possible.
I guess if all you have to hang up is on one, well, that's probably a good idea.
Practically speaking, that's correct.
Any other questions for Mr. McCune? Blair, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
We have lost a significant number of our committee here.
Let's move this thing.
Yeah. We'll reduce, let's see, special order. We can get the quorum to consist of two members.
Chairman, we can take testimony on other legislation.
I think that's in order. And there are no other questions on this bill. We'll
put it aside momentarily.
And I think Ms. Carpinetti is going to be back in the not too distant future with an amendment. And maybe some of our members will come back. I know one is testifying or is on television right now.
On television.
We could get probably another one from upstairs, but With that in mind, we will set 216 aside and go to 219, Office of Victims Advocacy. And we have another of the good senator's staffers with us. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brett Huber. I'm staff to Senator Halford, prime sponsor of SB 219. I just had a rather lengthy discussion about the costs of incarceration versus the incarcerative commitment, et cetera, and drawing your attention to the previous legislation's fiscal note. I'd also note that $30 million annually is now spent either prosecuting or defending criminals. In 1994, November 8th of 94, 86% of the ballots ratified the Victims' Rights Amendment to the Alaska Constitution, which provided victims with constitutional rights when dealing with criminal acts that they were a victim to or related or a victim by relationship. Including your committee packets should be a sponsor statement, a sectional analysis, and various letters of support for Senate Bill 219. SB 219 establishes the Office of Victims' Rights in the legislative branch and tasks the victim's advocate with assisting crime victims in obtaining the rights they're guaranteed under the Constitution and laws of the state with regards to the contacts they have with state justice agencies. Mr. Chairman, we heard heartfelt testimony in this bill before the Senate Judiciary Committee that showed us that crime victims are all too often left to deal with a justice system that's heavily weighted to the benefit of the criminal, that's full of legalese and technicalities, and virtually impossible for anyone other than an attorney to understand. Passage of Senate Bill 219 will provide victims of crime with an advocate that understands and is experienced in criminal law and with the justice process. This bill does not preclude the responsibility of the prosecutor's office to fulfill their statutory obligations. This bill as well does not preclude the need for organizations such as the nationally recognized Victims for Justice. Their effectiveness, already exemplary, will be boasted by the Office of Victims' Rights. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my initial presentation. I'd be happy to briefly outline the sections of the bill if you'd like or respond to questions. And also, sir, I've provided an amendment in consultation with the Department of Law. They had a couple concerns of the draft as it came to your committee. I've provided an amendment for the committee's consideration that addresses those concerns. Tell me how you'd like to proceed, sir.
Is lockup A1?
That's correct.
5698?
That's correct. Okay.
Well, I'd be glad to introduce that amendment. However, as you see, we don't have enough people to to do anything with it at the present time.
I could certainly outline the bill briefly if you'd like me to
do that. Would be good for the record.
Okay. Section 1 of the bill simply provides a short title. Section 2 of the bill is a section amending AS-12, allowing the advocate, the victim's advocate to make statements at time of sentencing in lieu of a victim if the victim chooses to have the advocate make the statement instead. Section 3 of the bill brings the victim's advocate under the legislative ethics. This office was built basically on the model as far as how to appoint, terms of removal, etc., on the model that the ombudsman follows now. Section 4 of the bill is the chapter that creates the Office of Victims Advocacy, or the Office of Victims' Rights. Sections inside of Section 4010 creates the office. 020 provides appointment procedures. 030 establishes qualifications. 040 provides for a term of office. 050 provides for removal of the victim's advocate. 060 lists the salary for the advocate. 070 allows employment of staff and establishes their duties and provides contractual provides the victim's advocate the ability to contract for services to provide it under the chapter. 080 addresses office space and administration. 090 requires the advocate to adopt regulations. 100 establishes the victim's advocate's jurisdiction, and that's a portion of it the amendment addresses. 110 sets forth advocate's duties and powers. 120 lists how and when the advocate may conduct investigations of denial of crime victims' rights. 130 provides subpoena power to victim's advocate. 140 requires consultation with the justice agency prior to releasing a report. 150 is the advocate's duties upon completion of investigation. 160 permits the advocate to publish opinions and recommendations. 170 requires the advocate to publish an annual report. 180 limits judicial challenge of the advocate's actions. 190 provides immunity to the advocate. 200 provides evidentiary privilege against being compelled to testify to the advocate. 210 sets out criminal penalty for obstruction of victims' advocates' duties. 250 provides the definitions. Section 5 of the bill provides the OVR the option of adopting longevity pay provisions. Section 6 of the bill, an amendment offered in the Senate Finance Committee, extends the period for permanent fund ineligibility from 1 to 2 years. I believe you heard another bill on the topic that this language mirrors the language in the other legislation. Section 7 of the bill provides the proceeds of that forfeiture may be used to fund the OVR, of course subject to legislative appropriation. Section 8 of the bill exempts regulations promulgated by the OVR from gubernatorial review. Section 9 of the bill exempts a victim's advocate from some of the administrative procedures record keeping requirements. Section 10 of the bill provides a sunset review of agencies to include their interaction with the Office of Victims Advocacy or Office of Victims' Rights. Section 11 of the bill names the Office of Victims' Rights as a state agency for purposes of state publications, and Section 12 and 13 provide notice of and provide the court rule changes.
Representative Roper.
Sure, Mr. Huber, I noticed in the bill package, which I'm trying to filter through, some pages from the front section of the budget, has this been funded right now in regards to the fiscal note or what?
Representative Roper, through the chair. Fiscal note, actually, and this is something we'll bring up, I actually talked to the Senate finance staff about today. The way the appointment procedures and the beginning of this office works, it would take the next legislature to appoint the victim's advocate and establish the office. So although the fiscal note shows an FY99 cost, there's no anticipated cost in FY99. Fiscal note was prepared thinking there was time for passage of the bill and the appointment procedures this legislative session. The Senate Finance Committee's concern, although all members were supportive of the bill, their concern was, is this a new general fund funding draw in the legislative side? That's why the tie to the PFD forfeiture and that avenue as a funding source for this office if future appropriations choose that. If the bill passes now, I would imagine the fiscal note question would be subject to conference committee as the other fiscal notes are. Again, the office can't be put together without an advocate being appointed, so I anticipate no FY99 cost.
Would you also suggest, or did I misunderstand you, that you do have a other funding source here then, that is the PFD?
That's correct, sir.
And that would amount to that much money? We're talking about almost $500,000.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, testimony and information provided by the PFD folks tell us that the second year ineligibility is estimated revenue stream of up to $4 million. So the funding mechanism more than exceeds the requirement of the bill.
Yes, Senator Berkowitz.
A couple of questions. Procedurally, how is this office going to work? At what point do they become engaged, and how do they engage in the process?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, there's an amendment that's in your packet that addresses a portion of the jurisdictional questions. Procedurally, the way it works is it says anybody that feels like their constitutional victims' rights are being denied or wants assistance or to be able to discuss their situation with victims' rights has the opportunity, providing that it's either a felony offense or certain misdemeanor offenses. The bill also provides that the Office of Victims' Rights can establish a priority. As you well know, there are many criminal cases and way too many victims. They're going to have to be able to address those that they can with staffing and budgetary constraints. If somebody comes and says, you know, I feel like somebody comes and has a complaint, I've not been given the opportunity to be involved in my case. I'm a victim and I feel left out of the process. That victim can go to the Office of Victims' Rights and say, here's my situation. The victim's advocate then can choose to pursue that, to look at the facts, to see if he does indeed feel like there's been some abrogation of the victim's constitutional rights. If that's the case, then the victim's advocate is empowered to both advocate on behalf of the victim or investigate after the fact. If somebody comes and says, my case is done, everything's over, I came to the courtroom, I wasn't allowed to give my testimony as a victim at time of sentencing, I don't feel this is right, I'd like you to do something about it, then the victim's advocate has the opportunity to perform an investigation, much like the ombudsman does currently with other state agencies outside the justice agencies. And the victim's advocate can then go through the set procedures to investigate, consult with the justice agencies, publish a report, make recommendations.
Mr. Berkowitz?
You indicated that they would have to prioritize, so that would mean some people with complaints might not get them heard. That raises usually the specter of equal protection or due process problems. Has there been any testimony about that in any of the other committees?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, the testimony in other committees has been limited merely to the fact that there are more cases, especially with the expansion by an amendment in Senate Judiciary to add some misdemeanor cases. The caseload is high in the sexual assault and DV cases. There's not been brought to any committee's attention a problem with equal access. Constitutional rights are constitutional rights. It's not the idea that the Office of Victims' Rights becomes somebody's civil attorney in a case where they feel like their rights have been abridged by the justice agency.
I don't mean that. I mean in the sense of, as a citizen, if I'm in a position and this office is providing a service, and I'm in a position to seek your services, and you give me those services, but another like-situated individual is for some reason denied access to those services, that's problematic.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, I believe you see that same situation now with the current Office of the Ombudsman. It's not that they're denied services. It's that you have to operate inside of what your staff and budgetary constraints are.
Well, the distinction, if I could, is that here you're predicating the formation of this office on a constitutional basis. The Ombudsman doesn't have constitutional basis. Here you're saying that because we have victims' rights, victims shall use this office or can use this office. And so my constitutional right as victim B, who hasn't been able to employ or use your services, are somehow shorted as compared to the other victim.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, your constitutional rights are the same as my constitutional rights, whether we choose to avail ourselves of this office or whether this office can handle our case in as timely a manner. The Constitution merely says, here are your rights as a victim. As all other constitutional provisions, then you come down to statutory provisions. The statutory provisions for the implementation of this office do provide that the Office of Victims' Rights can prioritize and handle the cases that they can. But that in no way diminishes your constitutional rights. They're intact, as are mine.
Follow up.
Assuming you have a crime with two victims, one victim wants your services, the other one doesn't, how would you proceed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, currently a victim is defined in statute, but there is some discretion to the court as who that named victim is. And let me see if I can, that's statutory site. 1255-185 defines a victim as a person against whom an offense has been perpetrated. B, one of the following, not the perpetrator, if the person specified in A of this paragraph is a minor, incompetent, or incapacitated. B sub 1, an individual living in spousal relationship with the person specified in A of this paragraph. B sub double I, a parent, adult, child, guardian, or custodian of the person. C, one of the following, not the perpetrator, if the person specified in A of this paragraph is dead. And 1, 2, and 3, a person. If you look at the statutory definition of victim, although you may have five brothers or five siblings whose parent was murdered, and they all indeed a victim in that they have lost their parent, the way the statute reads and the way the court determines, it boils down to a victim.
What are we on now?
Certainly, if you had two siblings and one chose to use the OVR and the other did not, the OVR is going to proceed in the case at their discretion for the person that comes forward and asks for their assistance.
Just also procedurally, on page 8, You indicate the section doesn't authorize the victim's advocate to issue a subpoena to a justice or a judge or a jury. Would you be able to subpoena a law clerk or an in-court clerk?
Can you give me the cite on page?
Page 8, lines 4 through 7.
A justice, magistrate, or magistrate concerning a judicial action or non-action taken by the justice, judge, or magistrate, and the jury. Both of this amendment was actually adopted in Senate Judiciary at the request of the court system. Their concern was that the actual judicial decision should not come under question, but that any procedural, and the court's testimony was that they have very little problem with procedural problems in applying these constitutional rights, that more often it's more, more of the responsibility falls to the Department of Law and the prosecutor's office than does the courts. The court system had no problem with being questioned on procedural. That's why they asked to limit it, or they recommend we limit it just to concerning a judicial action or non-action or a decision.
And oftentimes, having been a law clerk, you're very much intertwined with what the judge is doing. And it would backdoor a judge's insulation from the process. If you could say, okay, judge, we're not talking to you, but we're grabbing your law clerk and we're going to talk to him or to her.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, as I said, the court system offered this amendment. They're comfortable with the language. Since we've taken away the idea of judicial action or the decision, I think only the law clerk, if allowed, would not be allowed to be questioned under those decisions, but only something procedural. But again, you perhaps ought to address that question to the courts. They did bring the amendment, and they're comfortable with the language as adopted.
Just two other questions on this subject. That would mean also that you would have the ability to subpoena members of the prosecution?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, that's correct.
And you would also have the ability to subpoena law enforcement?
Again, through the chair, that's also correct.
And these proceedings are to be done publicly? Publicly, once the subpoena is done and the investigation?
Through the chair, you're talking about an investigation, not advocacy, when you're talking about subpoenaing people after the fact, after a decision's been made. The would not have to be subject to public hearing. As a matter of fact, the Office of Victims' Rights is barred from release of confidential information or is barred from pre-release of reports before taking that preliminary report, as the Ombudsman does, to the agency affected, getting their recommendations, and then at a later date, publishing the final report and recommendations.
I'm sorry for going on so long, but I do have a lot of questions about mm-hmm. this because it does involve a subject that I'm somewhat familiar with. During the investigation, page 7, the victim's advocate may make inquiries and obtain information considered necessary. Now, would an individual be allowed under those proceedings to invoke Fifth Amendment rights, for example, or what procedural safeguards would an individual have? Would you be allowed to have an attorney with you? Would you be allowed to cross-examine people who were making inquiry of you? How would it work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, I know nothing in this legislation that changes anybody's right, anybody's constitutional right or right of due process procedure. I would say certainly you'd be able to take the Fifth. I would say certainly you would be able to, you're not going to be disallowed legal counsel.
In all due respect, I disagree. This is a huge change in how criminal processes work. And it's historically been an adversarial process with an arbitrator. And all of a sudden, we're interjecting a new agency. This could possibly be a good policy call to do, but it's something that I think ought to be done very carefully because there's a lot of possibility for unintended consequences.
Representative Berkowitz, I would agree with you. That's why we have spent a considerable amount of time talking to prosecutors. We've heard from defense attorneys. We've spent a great deal of time with the Department of Law in consultation over the legislation. It's been through the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Senate Finance Committee. many of these questions have been explored. I agree with you. It's not something to be taken lightly, and we've made a great deal of effort to involve the court system, the Department of Law, the prosecutors, other defenders, and agencies currently tasked to assist victims as well as nonprofits assisting victims.
And we are going to hear from the court system.
Okay. And is this legislation modeled after something that's occurred in other jurisdictions, or is this something we're attempting here?
Mr. Chairman, the legislation, the model of the office is somewhat loosely modeled after the Ombudsman's office. But I don't know of another agency like this in another state. But again, we have a unique constitutional provision adopted in 1994 that made a promise to the voters, 86% of whom who ratified that amendment, that you have constitutional rights. Senator Halford believes it's time to put in a practical mechanism to help make sure those rights are implemented.
There are other states that have victims' rights, so that's why I was asking. I guess I can ask more later, but I'll wait.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, Bert Roper.
Chairman, I'm just trying to familiarize myself with this bill. It seems that I appreciate the fact that there are constitutional rights for the victims, but then in terms of the investigation section, it says when they're denied those rights, then I'm concerned about who in fact would be denying them those rights, and then when in fact we can't have the actual the judge, who to me seems to be the primary officer responsible for overseeing the rights of the victims as it relate to the process now and as to the way we have statutorily constructed the process, you know, unless it is the administrator of the courts or something. I'm not sure who's going to be denying these rights, unless it is the judge, and then you can't subpoena him anyway now. That's prohibited. So what are we doing here? Who are we trying to seek out?
Representative Roper, through the chair. Actually, the Department of Law, the prosecutors are specifically tasked in statute now with some of the provisions that provide the mechanism for making available the constitutional rights. For example, to be able to consult with the prosecutors, if you read the language of the Victims' Rights Amendment, to be able to be involved in and consult with the prosecution and investigation of the case, to be able to make a statement at the time of sentencing, there are statutes on the books that specifically task the prosecutor's office with certain responsibilities under that constitutional amendment. You have to make a separation. It is not this legislation does nothing for somebody that says the judge or jury made a bad decision. That's completely off the table in this legislation. That's what the appellate court's for. That's what civil proceedings are for. What this does is say, I was told that I had these rights. The statute says I can make a statement at the time of sentencing. The statute says that I should be consulted or involved in this process. I feel like those have been abridged. That's not the judge, for the most part, and court's testimony in past hearings was, for the most part, where they know of complaints coming forward. They've been process complaints, and mainly on the prosecutorial side. We're not attempting to influence or attempting to review specific judicial action. There are other avenues for that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there was a circumstance or a constituent in my district. I had a child involved in a vehicular homicide, which had a very strange fact pattern, and she was complaining about the district attorney not bringing a particular cause of action or had misdirected the case. It seems to me that she could use this to harass that prosecutor because she disagreed with his judgment in the case. So what's to protect those folks?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roper, what's to protect those folks is two things. Prosecutorial discretion rests in the executive. It rests in the prosecutor's office. They make determinations all the time to what level do they bring a charge, what plea bargain is reasonable, how to proceed with an investigation, and how to proceed with the court proceeding. There are people that feel like the proceedings were not the way they'd have liked them to go, that there were things that were left out of the process, that there were poor decisions made. After the fact, if somebody comes forward to the Office of Victims Rights and say, I believe that because they didn't do A, this constitutional right was abridged. That's exactly what this office is tasked to do. Go in and take a look at the facts of the case. Determine whether there was a constitutional right or a problem with this person's constitutional rights under the Victims' Rights Act. If that's the case, they will pull documents. They can subpoena persons involved in the prosecution and investigation. They can come up with what they believe the facts were and what was or wasn't done correctly. Then they go to the justice agency that they're dealing with and say, here's our preliminary report. Here's what we think the recommendations are. Here's what we're finding. Please respond to this, just as the Ombudsman's Office does now. The justice agency then responds. The victim's advocate then looks at all the information and says, here are my findings. Here is my report. Here are my recommendations. And then they come forward.
But, Mr. Chairman, are you suggesting then that a victim who couldn't enforce an alleged right to say that the prosecutor made an error of judgment in bringing a particular type of case or didn't do a good plea bargain or something like that, can they second-guess the prosecutor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rookberg, I think there are victims now that second-guess the prosecutor's decision. Prosecutorial discretion still lies with the prosecutor. The idea is we have victims out there now that at the worst possible time, when they've just been victimized, when their life has already been shaken, are thrown into a system full of legalities that if you're not a lawyer, you don't understand what may or may not have been done correctly. This opportunity to have somebody that's familiar with the process, that has a criminal law background, that's served in the capacity and dealt with these issues before, to be able to take a reasoned look at this, and perhaps it's just an initial consultation and they say, you know, I understand that you feel bad about this. In my opinion, what happened was completely inside the prosecutorial discretion. Perhaps what you need to do is look for assistance in dealing with where you're at now and moving your life forward. Perhaps their constitutional rights have been abridged in the opinion of the Office of Victims Advocacy, and the investigation proceeds, and if those findings come out, then we want this office to be able to bring there. If you ask victims now, they feel like there's certain shortcomings in the judicial system. One of the statements that was probably the most powerful in Senate Judiciary was the prosecutor, the criminal has on their side all of the constitutional protections of somebody that's accused. On the prosecutor's side, it's the full force and weight of the state that's bringing the case. And as this woman put it, the victim is currently left in the shadow of justice. This is just to allow them to have somebody that an office, an advocate, somebody that can help them through the process and understanding the process and ensure that their constitutional rights are protected as the process goes on.
Well, yes or no would have been fine, but in terms of the penalty, what's the remedy here? It's a misdemeanor punishable by $1,000, but what else are we going to do to remedy these abridgment of constitutional rights? Is there any other remedies available?
Mr. Chairman, I'll keep it more brief, but I don't think I can do that one with a yes or no. The penalty provisions are only for somebody that's obstructing the right. Victim's office from doing their job. This was not set up to punish prosecutors. It was not set up to punish the courts. It was set up to give the public a better understanding of what happens in the process.
Are we institutionalizing nagging here or jawboning or what are we doing here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rookberg, I'm not sure how to respond to that other than I believe many of the issues that the legislature chooses to deal with in the future are ones that are brought forward by their constituents that have been put in a situation that they don't want to be back in.
Well, what's the remedy? I mean, what are we going to offer these people that goes to this new agency and asks that this be investigated and they don't like what happened here and here and there's a finding that there was errors there, then what happened?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rookberg, ideally what happens is I believe that report comes out, this information comes forward, the justice agencies that have done something that could have done better have been told what the recommendation of the Office of Victims' Rights was. Again, if somebody feels like their constitutional rights have been aggrieved, of course they can bring suit with or without this office. If they feel like the decision was an error, of course they can appeal or they can try to bring civil litigation.
Appeal to whom?
Representative Berkowitz.
Representative Berkowitz, I guess appeal was probably the wrong choice of words. The appeal would be on the side of who's convicted, but certainly civil remedies are something that we sought, as in we saw in the O.J. Simpson case. No criminal conviction, but a civil case to follow that offered some kind of satisfaction at a different level of evidence.
Representative Berkowitz.
I'm a prosecutor. I do something that the Office of Victim Advocates sees as wrong. They write a scathing report about me. I come out with contrary evidence. Who do I take that evidence to?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, I believe you would take that evidence to your superiors inside the Department of Law, who you're working for as a prosecutor, and say, this is why I did what I did.
So
there's no specific penalty for you in that.
I've been publicly censured, and I don't have a public avenue to gain my good name back.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, again, before that report is issued in final, the agency is consulted and has an opportunity to answer. That answer is a part of the report that's published as it is in the Ombudsman's office. So for the same level that the censure, as you refer to it, is made public, as is your response.
Representative Berkowitz. Currently, you know, a lot of offices, I don't know if they still fund them, there used to be something known as the Victim Witness Coordinator. Most prosecutors' offices. Usually they're underfunded because most prosecutors are underfunded and strapped. But these were the people whose jobs it was to explain to victims how the process was supposed to work. They were to explain to them how the system was working and explain to them the consequences of whatever had occurred. Aren't you saying that we don't need to fund those victim witness coordinators anymore, and instead we're going to have a bunch of lawyers in the Office of Victims Advocacy go into court and do battle in your stead?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, no, I'm not saying that at all. There are designated victim coordinators, I believe, in all of the offices of the Department of Public Law, with the exception of some one-person satellite offices. This legislation does not reach in and ask to divert those funds. This legislation does not relieve them of any of their statutory responsibilities to provide for the victims' rights. This merely provides an entity and somebody versed in the criminal system for the victim to be able to consult if they feel like their constitutional rights are being violated.
Take a different subject here. In terms of the separation of powers, this is sort of an interesting problem, because what you have here is a legislative entity, legislative branch entity, doing oversight on both the executive branch and the judicial branch. To me, that raises some real questions. I mean, I think of how we feel here when people, if someone were to come in and say, well, did we really do a good job putting a bill together and going through the right process with that bill? I would feel sort of resentful of someone from the executive looking over my shoulder, or someone from the judiciary looking over my shoulder. Don't you think that for us in the legislative branch to go out into the executive and the judicial branch, we're guilty of the same sin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, I guess I don't view it that way, and I think, again, you have to look back to the model that part of this was established on, which is the Ombudsman, which is a legislative branch function tasked to do exactly that with executive agency decisions and executive agency actions. Again, this is not brought forward as a punitive measure. This is brought forward, though, again, you represent the branch of government that's tasked with representing the people. It was this branch of government that brought the House Joint Resolution forward to provide the opportunity to vote on the constitutional amendment. It's this branch of government that's phone rings first, in my experience, when a constituent feels like they're having a problem with a state agency whether it be CSED or whether it be the Department of Law.
Actually, I would submit that CSED probably hears first and the Department of Law.
Well, let's not debate this issue. Let's stay on focus here.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I was just going to say, I mean, following this whole line, I still am not satisfied that we have remedy here and other than common law civil action. I'm not sure there's a tort for malfeasance, misfeasance, or something like that. There may be. Anyway, I guess the remedy is the editorial board of the Anchorage Daily News. And that's about the only thing I can think of right now, so I'm a little bit concerned about it. So we're talking about the public... Mm-hmm. What's the nice term here? I'm getting tired today.
Court of public opinion?
Court of public opinion. I just needed that old cliche, right? Anyway.
Representative James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't here when this first started, but I think I've caught up from where you are from all of the questions that you've had to ask. But it seems to me like that the purpose that is being served by this piece of legislation and setting up this Victims' Rights Council, whatever it's called, is to serve a purpose for these victims to be able to understand whether or not they have had all the opportunities they have had, all the opportunities that they were entitled to on this issue. And what I hear out there with the victims now and their complaint, and there are victims out there who don't believe that they're getting the information, is that they don't have a source of finding the information, number one. Number two, they don't know the legal ins and outs of what they can and can't do. So they don't know when to complain because they're not getting treated like they think they aren't treated or that they should be treated. And they don't have anywhere to go unless they hire themselves an attorney. And many of them, as victims, don't have very much money to be hiring an attorney. And so it seems to me like the purpose of this is for information to the victims. And then if the information is such that their constitutional rights are being violated, they have somebody to tell them what the next step is, and maybe it is to go hire an attorney and file a case against them. Or the Victims' Rights Council could also let them know when it's time for them to do something. Because, you know, now is the time that this is what you're entitled to. Now is the time you need to do this. So it seems to me like it's purely and simply almost like the other kinds of advocacies that we have in the state for other people who cannot represent themselves because they are vulnerable or they are disenfranchised in some way, and that they need to have an advocate for them, and that this provides that. And the only time there'd be any punitive kinds of treatment is because someone did leave their rights out and they would have a case to file against that for whatever good that would be, or to let them know when they're supposed to do it. I see a real advantage to this issue. I don't know who pays for it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative James, that is the intent of this legislation. The fiscal note will show you that it's about $500,000 projected annual cost. There's a funding mechanism, a potential funding source included in the bill in the increased revocation of PFDs for convicted felons or multi-misdemeanants. It will appear as an item in the legislative budget. That's a possible sub-funding source, as are many others subject to your appropriations.
And you missed earlier when we talked about that I believe you said that the indication was that this actually would be a moneymaker rather than an expense.
And Mr. Chairman, again, it's a mirror language on the PFD and eligibility to Senate Bill 274 that I believe your committee has already heard. And information that we've received from PFD folks is the approximately potential of a $4 million revenue stream from that increased ineligibility.
If I might go on, Mr. Chairman, well, it appears to me we are hoping we can eliminate victims. I mean, that's one of the other things that we're trying to do, is to try to not have these criminals out on the street doing these dastardly things. But I don't have any real hope in the very near distant future that we're going to do away with victims. But I think that we have made the statement, the people have passed the constitutional amendment that says that these victims have certain rights. And if they're not getting them, or don't know if they're getting them, or are confused and don't know where they're going, that this will be a solution to that. And I, you know, quite frankly, I think it is a good idea.
Representative Berkowitz.
Do you have any indication of how often victims' rights are violated, any quantitative study?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, no, I do not have any quantitative data. I can give you some anecdotal data on a personal level.
I can go through anecdotal data all day. I've worked in the courts, and I, you know, based on my anecdotal data, most of it wouldn't get by an attorney's evaluation. And I also, the other question I had is, currently we have the Victims for Justice and Court Watch, who do very good jobs up in Anchorage and keeping an eye on things and explaining to victims how the process works, shepherding them through the process. In a way, aren't we supplanting with a governmental agency something that's being done privately?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, Victims for Justice does an excellent job. The sponsor of this legislation has long supported the work of Victims for Justice. Victims for Justice is on record in support of this legislation and as a priority in this legislative session. They feel like having the folks that they're helping at the level they are, having access to an agency like this with the legal expertise, will help them in their task, not hinder their task.
Okay, we have an amendment to this piece of legislation.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Brokert.
I would move the A.1 lockup 5698 amendment, if you want to mark it amendment number one.
It is indeed amendment number one.
I move the amendment.
Is there objection to amendment number one?
I haven't read it.
It's okay.
Mr. Chairman, for Representative James' benefit, that amendment was suggested and worked with the Department of Law to meet a couple of concerns they had with the bill, and the sponsor concurs with the amendment.
Okay. Hearing no objection, amendment number one is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Huber, does this bill have a Finance Committee referral also because of the note?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roper, yes, it does. It's been through the Senate Finance Committee. It goes to House Finance next.
I have a question on the amendment, actually, and I agree with it, but how is the victim advocate going to determine whether the exercise of their jurisdiction interferes with the criminal investigation without interfering with that criminal investigation? I mean, necessarily, it seemed to me you're going to have consultation with the prosecutors or with the law enforcement to make some kind of determination, which even if you get a no answer, there's a lot of times the proceedings are cloaked in some degree of secrecy because you don't want information to get out. And if the prosecutor is put in a position of saying, I'm not going to talk about this, that's the kind of non-answer that can jeopardize an ongoing investigation or prosecution.
Mr. Chairman, also contained in the amendment is a portion that speaks to the confidentiality of the information that's gleaned in the investigation and advocacy process.
And I'm particularly concerned in cases, for example, of domestic violence, where a lot of times what will happen is the perpetrator will lean on the victim. I've been in situations where perpetrators have stayed downstairs and at gunpoint ordered their spouse upstairs. It's just outrageous sort of conduct, but just by coming back with a non-answer from the Office of Victims Advocacy, by creating this other entity out there, you can exacerbate the kind of problems that are associated with domestic violence.
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, I think you do have a valid concern. One of the ways that we believe we've addressed that concern is through the process of qualification and appointment for the victim's advocate. If you had somebody in this position that wanted to run amok, I would imagine he'd create problems.
Yeah, maybe I'm not making it clear. It's not the Office of Victim Advocacy that I'm worried about. It's you have a perpetrator sends a victim into the office, say, the victim says, I need to know, I don't want to prosecute, I don't want to testify. The office goes and talks to the prosecutor and says, the victim doesn't want to prosecute, doesn't want to testify. Prosecutor says, tough luck. You know, it's not the victim's call, which is the way it happens. Office comes back, tells the victim, you still have to testify. The office in that way is, because it's set up as the victim's voice, can be a conduit for further violence to the victim.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, I understand what you're saying, but
saying you didn't get your mouthpiece to do to argue correctly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, I guess I understand your point, but I'm not certain how that same eventuality isn't out there with or without the Office of Victims' Rights. And certainly I understand that there are times that somebody comes forward, especially in cases of domestic violence, and I mean these are people that have been manipulated, that have been threatened, that feel threatened. And to come forward in the first place when they've been wronged and ask for help is an incredible first step. After that, you have somebody that's been manipulating them for perhaps years, saying, if you go any farther, it's going to get worse for you instead of better. And I think there are other agencies out there that also have the opportunity on you know, both from the more governmental side as well as from the nonprofit side that deal with these situations that face that same kind of situation, whether you're talking about a DV shelter or whether you're talking about the council. That's a problem, but I think that problem is more driven by the type of crime and the manipulative perpetrator than it is whether the Office of Victims' Rights exists or not.
Sure, there's some DV advocates here. I guess when they testify, I'd like to hear what they have to say about that problem.
Okay. Any other questions of the sponsor? We have a couple of people in the audience who have signed up. Thank you, Brett. Nancy Jones?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Nancy Jones, the Director of the Permanent Fund Dividend Division, and members of the committee. First of all, I'd like to correct the amount that was estimated, or that they think that we said was available. We have no statistics at all on any of holding what it would take to hold, I mean, how much money would be earned from holding another year's dividend out, which is the provision of this bill. This year, the felons dividends that we, the ceiling amount that we gave ONB was $3.9 million to $4 million.
What was that amount?
3.9. And that is funding Department of Public Safety and Corrections and the Office of Domestic Violence, the Council on Domestic Violence, Crime Victim Compensation. It pays for gate fees when people are released from jail. So it's a variety of things that it has been doing. In 1995, there was a provision added to include misdemeanors. We haven't been able to collect that data yet because the reporting period for misdemeanors won't be until next year. So there's been an increase to that pot. This bill and 274 by Senator Ward now adds an additional pot to the same pot of people who become ineligible because of their dividend. We have a concern for PFD based on the felon program when it first started in 1988. It was taken, we were challenged, and it was taken all the way to the Supreme Court. And the court ruled that it was a legitimate purpose in mind to withhold these dividends. And it was for people who were incarcerated, one, their cost of care and keeping. Our concern is, which stems from Senator Ward's bill, is one, they're charging a parole fee, which if they don't pay it, we levy, which is another provision. This provision that's in this bill, which is just like the second part of that other bill, says that you are ineligible if in fact you were incarcerated in any of 2 years. So 1 year we would automatically get it anyway because you're in jail. It's the second year when you're out of jail that we normally wouldn't get the dividend, and now we're going to get the dividend. So also in the bill, it says that there is a cost of these people being on parole. It mentions $3 and something cents. The dividend is constantly increasing, so there becomes a provision that if you say the cost is X, but I'm taking X plus Y, who gets the refund? And how are we going to have a cost associated with this particular item? So it seems that in taking that second year dividend, then we start to be in this field of people who normally wouldn't get paid a dividend, because if they die when they get out of jail, if they relocate, the provisions of this bill is saying because they were in jail 2 years ago that I have to estimate a dividend for them, when normally if they were, if we didn't have this provision, they wouldn't be applying. So then that starts to get in your pocket and my pocket as far as the dividend, because I'm paying people who otherwise wouldn't be eligible. Just because of this provision to say, because you were in jail 2 years ago, I'm taking this dividend over here without you applying. And that's the big thing. These people are not applying. It's just because their names, they were incarcerated for 1 year. The Department of Corrections ran some numbers, and they started with 1996, because the 3.9 million that I gave to, or the number that I gave to OMB, is based on people who were incarcerated in 1996. So the Department of Corrections followed those people. How many of those people did not return to jail in 1997? And they came up with 1,100. So with 1,100 people that were on probation or parole would be a partial number that I would have to run them through an eligibility kind of test to see how many of those people then I would calculate how much of a dividend they would have gotten had they not been in prison. So it's confusing on two hands. One, I'm afraid that it won't stand up in court when we're challenged like we were when the felons program first came out. It was a class action suit against us. I don't think holding this additional year's dividend will muster that same test, that there is a legitimate purpose for holding dividends from people who are no longer in jail to the excess of whatever cost that we're saying it is. Even if they're on probation for 6 months, we're still taking a year's worth of dividend. I mean, you know, taking the dividend when their calculation comes out so many days times $3.33 a day. So that is our concern as far as PFD, that we don't have clear direction of how these pieces and parts are operating and the constitutionality, I guess, of this provision. The second part is a concern by CSED that since these people are not in jail and would normally be out and perhaps eligible for a dividend, they would be able to pass that dividend on to pay their debts, one of them being child support. Since we can only go by what the Department of Correction has given us of 1,100 people, that's like $1.4 million based on the 1997 dividend that would be available to these people. And we know from our statistics that every year with about a 3% increase, the amount of claims that Child Support Enforcement Division gives the division to levy on dividends, the increase is about 3%. So just based on those numbers, there are going to be some of these people that are on parole and probation that normally would get a dividend that was available to CSED to go both to the Wealth Public Assistance reimbursement and directly to children, and to help levy their budget to get federal funds, will no longer be available to CSED.
Sure, on that point, would this thing also jump ahead of restitution, fines, and civil debts?
The provision that's in this bill 219, by them being ineligible, it definitely jumps ahead of everything, because now we're saying these people are ineligible for the dividend, and I take their money they would have gotten and give it totally to state government.
So we're going to be funding state government before we pay victims?
Exactly, with this provision in this bill. That's exactly what it does.
And we'll, just so I'm clear, so we'll also fund state government before we pay civil creditors.
Everyone.
Any other questions of Nancy?
Finance problem.
Something, Mr. Chairman, I do have a question.
Representative James.
And I didn't, I don't know where that is in the bill that says that, and maybe Nancy does. But the issue of that you are going to set aside this money to pay whether they file an application or not, is that what you said?
Right. It's on page 10. And it's line 14. And it says during, this is the new part, during all or part of either of the two calendar years immediately preceding that dividend year, the individual was incarcerated as a result of the conviction in the state of a felony or misdemeanor if the individual has been convicted of two or more crimes. So if any of those 2 years you were incarcerated as a result of being a felon or creating a third time misdemeanor, your dividend will be taken in once you are released from jail. We automatically get it if you commit those two crimes if you're incarcerated. But we're talking this extra provision, which either of 2 years means the year that you're out, that we wouldn't normally have gotten your dividend. This bill is making it mandatory that you are ineligible for the dividend, and instead we give the money to state government.
But if I might, they would have to make an application, though, wouldn't they?
No. These people don't make an application, felons or misdemeanors that are already incarcerated. Department of Corrections.
Even the year that they're in?
Correct. Even the year that they're in, they do not make an application.
Somebody has to make an application.
No, we don't. Department of Corrections gives me a list of people who were incarcerated during our qualifying year for the dividend, and I run those people through eligibility criteria to determine how many of those people would, if they would be out on the street, be eligible for a dividend. And we multiply that by, and that becomes the ceiling in which OMB can then budget. And there's a provision in here that they cannot budget any more than the ceiling of the amount that was given in the previous year. Otherwise, we would have to list specifically every use of every dollar that we gave them. Otherwise, now it's just...
I get it now. Okay. And yeah, it is a finance issue. I don't want to deal with it, but I agree that there's some problems there.
All right. Any other questions, Nancy? If not, we have Chris Christensen. And there may be some questions for you, Chris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen, General Counsel to the Judicial Branch. Mr. Chairman, the Supreme Court takes no position on this legislation. I'm here to express two concerns about the legislation, but before I do, if I may respond to an issue raised by Representative Berkowitz. He asked whether or not law clerks should be excluded from the subpoena. Mr. Chairman, I had originally drafted an amendment that took care of that problem. And as is frequently the case, amendments get sent off to legal services and they come back in a form that people don't recognize. As Representative Berkowitz did point out, law clerks do act as the agent of the judicial officer, doing research at the judicial officer's direction, writing briefing materials at the judicial officer's direction. And if you subpoena the law clerk, in a sense, you are subpoenaing the judge because you're gaining access to the judge's thought processes. So while this amendment was added to the bill at my request, it was not added in the form I requested. And I don't know, but I believe it was a legal services issue.
Could we amend it to fulfill your concern?
Mr. Chairman, I would certainly appreciate it if that would take
place. This is the place.
Okay.
Then, before we forget, do something that happened inadvertently elsewhere, and I wouldn't be certain how you'd want it done, but conceptually I'd move that we incorporate at least law clerks, but I also like to put in courts as well and secretaries.
Mr. Chairman, the language that I had originally given said that a judicial officer or a person working under the direction of a judicial officer. And remember, this has to be for a judicial act. If it's an administrative act, you can subpoena the person and ask them anything you want. You can subpoena a judge for an administrative act. This is limited to judicial acts. So it would be the judicial officer or someone acting under the judicial officer's direction.
And you have language?
I have attempted to add language to the language that is in the bill. It's on page 8, line 4. Following magistrate, you would add, or a person working under the direction of a justice, judge, or magistrate.
Okay, you do that one more time.
Sure. After on line 4, after the word magistrate, add, mm-hmm. or a person working under the direction of a justice, judge, or magistrate.
Working or acting?
Or
acting is probably better.
Sure. So. And then on line 5, after the word by, add, or under the direction of.
Let's see.
And this is something I just attempted to work up while I was sitting in the audience, so it's.
I move that.
Oh, okay. You're repeating that again.
Okay.
You're repeating.
Yes. Yeah, so, well, because you're
what you said before. Right.
Non-action taken by or under the direction of.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I heard a recommender that you move that amendment. It has been amendment number 2. Has been moved. Is there objection? Hearing none, amendment number 2 is adopted. We can drop that little footnote off.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, before I talk about the what I think is a very minor thing that concerns us with this legislation, I'd like to tell you what doesn't concern us. The bill, as was pointed out, is a further implementation of the Victims' Rights Amendment to the state constitution, which the voters approved in 1994. It does a number of significant things which probably will make the system work better for victims. Some of the things we are not concerned about, for example, are the creation of the Office of the Advocate, the authority of an advocate to appear in court in lieu of a victim, because, Mr. Chairman, as you know, there are many people who are uncomfortable with that sort of public speaking, the ability of the advocate to obtain court records relating to an offense, even the ability of the advocate to investigate the administrative matters that take place in the court system with regard to a case. We've always kept our doors open to the ombudsman for their administrative investigations. And of course, I offer no comment on those sections of the bill which relate to the executive branch, the Office of the Prosecutor, and corrections, which have many duties under law related to victims. What I am concerned with, however, are two effects of the bill, which in my view go right to the heart of the justice system. First, it relates to juries. As drafted, the bill can be construed as allowing the advocate to issue a report critical of a jury's decision. For example, the Constitution requires a victim to be treated with dignity and respect. And frequently, a jury is essentially deciding who to believe. Frequently, a jury is deciding, in effect, that the victim is a liar. They don't believe the victim. Now, that certainly is a sort of decision that does not involve treating the victim with dignity and respect. The courts have always protected and shielded jurors. No one likes doing jury duty. Most people don't want to have to make hard choices that directly affect the lives of other individuals. If you live in one of the big cities, you do jury duty about every 5 years. If you live in one of the smaller communities, you get called every year. We have all seen cases in the national press in the last couple of years of juries being vilified in the press and the court of public opinion for decisions that people didn't like. We can't stop that. You know, you can vilify a jury in letters to the editor. It's your constitutional right. But we're concerned that people not be taken to task by a government official for decisions that they've rendered in good faith as part of a jury.
Mm-hmm.
Second, Mr. Chairman, and this is sort of the other side of the coin, that is the judicial acts. This bill, as it's drafted, would allow the advocate to issue a decision which said, in effect, that a judge or the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court was wrong on the law or wrong on the facts. Now, understand, I'm not talking about the administrative acts of the judicial officers. When a judge is acting administratively, he's no different than any other state bureaucrat and should be taken to task for his actions. But you know, we have a system of government which places final decisions on justice matters in the hands of judicial officers. It's not that way everywhere. There are countries where it's the parliament that is the final court, which acts as a supreme court. Now, this system isn't perfect. No system run by people is ever going to be perfect, but it does seem to work generally fairly well. This particular part of the legislation has the effect of turning this system on its head. It says that a mid-level bureaucrat in another branch actually gets the final say on whether or not justice was done in a particular case. He may not have the authority to actually overturn a decision, but he gets to tell the public, for example, that the Court of Appeals is just flat wrong and doesn't know what it's doing. Mr. Chairman, quite frankly, I guess I don't accept the premise that a single bureaucrat has some greater degree of insight into what the law means than the three members of the Court of Appeals or the five members of the Supreme Court. Aside from the obvious separation of powers problem, in my view, this will have the ultimate effect of decreasing the public's confidence in the justice system, not increasing it. And I think increasing it is what the thrust of this bill is really all about.
On that point,
Rickwitz,
what are the relative abilities of the court as opposed to the victim advocate to go public with the reasons and the substance of their decision?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, the judicial ethics code, called the canons of judicial conduct, prohibits a judicial officer from commenting publicly on a decision. The decision has to speak for itself. So in essence, a judge would be prohibited from defending a decision other than in the decision itself.
She'd be a sitting duck.
Representative James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seemed to me like, and maybe I didn't read this right, is that it seemed to me like the only complaints can be on the procedure, not necessarily on the decisions.
Through the chair, Representative James, it's bureaucrats sort of abhor a vacuum. I've been here 15 years, and my experience has been that if you leave waffle language in a bill, the bureaucrats will fill it. I think the intention of the bill was, I shouldn't speak to the intention of the bill. I listened to the testimony in judiciary, and there were some comments from members of the public that seemed to think that, yeah, when we're unhappy with decisions of the Court of Appeals or somebody, we would like to have somebody else to say, no, justice wasn't done, yes, this decision was wrong. But that's not really the system we're supposed to have. For better or worse, the judiciary is supposed to be the final say in whether or not justice was done in a case. Now, people are free to comment on that, exercise their First Amendment rights to comment on it, but we don't believe there should really be a government official who is charged by statute with interjecting his or her judgment in the basic question of whether justice is done. And as I said, this is, I think, a very, very tiny part of what this office will do. I think this is a significant piece, but a very small piece. I think 95% of what this advocate is going to do, I would expect to be things such as oversight of the rights guaranteed by statute, which are the duty of the other branches, or helping the person in court, not second-guessing a decision. You've got to remember that probably last year we had about somewhere between 3,000 and 3,500 felonies filed in the state, and about 20,000 misdemeanors, and probably 85% of those folks end up pleading guilty. And of the ones who go to trial, total less than 10% go to trial, I would expect at least half of them to be convicted. So you still have a fairly sizable block of folks who are very unhappy with the result they got. It's a tiny minority of all victims, but they're very unhappy. And I would expect that if there was an avenue for them to address their unhappiness, they would take it.
Isn't this bureaucrat, though, would be rendering opinion rather than legal, or law, rather, of law?
It would be an opinion. He could not overturn the decision, but he would be charged by statute with saying the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court or the trial judge was just flat wrong. They interpret the law incorrectly. Under our Constitution, it is that court that is supposed to be the final arbiter of what that statute means.
Would that be any different than an attorney taking up a case and saying, I'm going to file an appeal? That's also saying that he thinks the court made a mistake.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, and that is the method that the system provides.
This is an intervener in
the
system.
This is a government official who's actually been given a charge which is very similar to the court's charge, only it in essence supersedes the court. He gets the final say in whether or not justice was really done in this case. And in our mind, that just raises some very basic constitutional questions.
We've got some other people on top, too. No, Representative James.
Yeah, I just want to see, where does it say they can do this?
Madam Chairman, there's not a specific, Mr. Chairman, Representative James, there's not a specific section that says they can do this. If you read the bill as a whole, this would certainly be within their jurisdiction. And I had submitted an amendment to the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'd be happy to provide a copy of that to this committee if the members.
I appreciate that.
Page 8, line 29. Publication and recommendation.
Mr. Chairman.
Brett?
If I could clarify one thing.
The sponsor's point of view. Again, Brett Huber from Senator Halpert's office for the record. If you look at page 8 above line 29, subsection A says the victim's advocate shall report the advocate's opinion recommendations to a justice agency if the victim's advocate finds after investigation that an agency has denied a crime victim's rights, the crime victim is guaranteed under the Constitution. There is not the intent, nor do I know any place in this bill that says the victim's advocate can supplant his judicial decision for the judges. The judge is the only one making that. This report is only if the crime victim's rights in the opinion of the report with the response of the justice agency says a constitutional right has been denied the victim. It's certainly not the intent, nor I think the text of the legislation that says it's the victim's advocate's decision instead of the judge.
Chairman, I appreciate the statement that that's not the intent. Maybe I can give an example. Judges make evidentiary rulings all the time in a case. Some of those evidentiary rulings may go to those matters in the Constitution, the right to be treated with fairness and dignity, things of that nature. A jury's decision may turn on one particular evidentiary ruling made by a judge, and you will have the victim's advocate supplanting their judgment for the judges as to whether that evidentiary ruling on which the case hinged was in fact done correctly or not.
On that point, this opportunity for consultation, it seems it's fairly hollow as far as the judiciary is concerned, because in essence you'd have the victim's advocate saying there's been this complaint regarding this decision, and I don't know of an avenue that would allow a judge to reply back to that complaint, so that they might inform the judge that there's been a complaint, but the judge can't defend him or herself in any report. That's not part of what judges are supposed to be doing, as far as I know. I mean, if Chris knows something different, I'd...
Can't the presiding judge in the judicial district or the chief justice make some comments to the public if there were criticisms? Or is that still going to be under the canons?
Speaking through the chair, judges are prohibited from commenting on any matters that have been before the court or coming before the court. It's one of the basic principles of the English common law is that the decision has to speak for itself. This is actually something that happens in states where they have contested judicial elections, and that's one of the reasons that contested judicial elections have caused a lot of problems with the judiciary.
I wouldn't mind seeing what was rejected in the Senate.
Chairman, I'd like to see that too. I guess. If I might just make the comment that it seems to me like that there might be some language that we could put in here that would ensure that what he's talking about doesn't happen. I don't see a problem, but if there is a problem, we could take a look at that.